You are listening to Friends of Europe's podcast. Don't miss our debates on global and European issues that span political, economic, social, and environmental challenges, and follow our website at friendsofeurope.org.
Good afternoon, Excellencies, ladies and gentlemen. Friends of Europe is delighted to welcome you to our discussion today on Islam and the challenge of Muslim Democrats. I'm Shada Islam, I'm Director of Policy at Friends of Europe. We're really grateful to the Sasakawa Peace Foundation of Japan and think tank partners in Indonesia and Malaysia for drawing our attention to the role of Muslim Democrats and the challenges they face in this very turbulent and often violent world we live in. In a second, my colleague Mari Kogoso, who is director at the Sasakawa Peace Foundation, will explain a bit about the background of this meeting of the Forum for Muslim Democrats. But why is Friends of Europe interested in this subject? Well, first, very simply, because we believe that there is a bit too much ignorance about Islam's presence outside the Arab world. This is surprisingly widespread, this ignorance of what Islam is really like, its global outreach. For too many people, Islam is still often seen as a Middle Eastern religion, a preserve, a monopoly of the Arab world. The reality, as we know here, I hope, is that life is more complicated. The Middle East and North Africa represent about 20% of the world's 1.6 billion Muslims. 60% live in Asia. Second, we're interested because we think it is important to understand that there is more to Islam than the so-called Islamic State and the Wahhabi-Salafi interpretation of Islam that is spreading across the world and even here in Europe among Europe's Muslim communities. Third, we believe it is important to see this diversity, this plurality within Islam in action. Through our friends who at this panel will give us their narrative on Islam, which is about democracy and tolerance, rule of law, and not about austerity and conservatism. And finally, we're holding this conference because we believe that Muslim Democrats need to engage with each other in the Muslim world and with the European Union and others in the West, and vice versa. So this panel is about their story, their struggle, their challenges. Let me introduce the panel to you very briefly, and you'll see it's almost an all-female panel. We've got one token guy on the panel, but really, this is an amazing thing in Brussels, as you know. So I think felicitations, celebrate, you know, congratulations for that as well, ladies. So let me start off with introducing very briefly Ms. Nurul Izza. She's a member of the Malaysian Parliament and Vice President of the People's Justice Party. And Nurul is, of course, the daughter of Anwar Ibrahim, a very famous Malaysian opposition politician. But I assure you, she's a very celebrated politician, charismatic politician in her own right. Professor Azumardi Azra is Senior Professor of Islamic History and Culture at the Syarif Hidayatullah State Islamic University in Jakarta. He's a specialist in interfaith relations, and he's been here at the Leuven University as well for a stint. Ima Rahima Abdul Rahim, a very good friend of mine, is Executive Director of the world-famous Habibi Center in Indonesia, which works on democracy and human rights. And Mereta Bilder is policy advisor at the European External Action Service, working on issues related to religion and politics. So welcome all of you, and we're going to kickstart with giving the floor. Marik, if I could ask you to please come here and give us a few words of introduction.
Thank you very much. Distinguished panelists, distinguished guests, ladies and gentlemen, good afternoon to you all. I am Mari Kogiso, Director of the International Project Planning Department of the Sasakawa Peace Foundation. It is indeed a privilege and honor for me to make an introductory remark at the outset of this panel discussion on Islam and challenge of Muslim Democrats. First of all, on behalf of the Sasakawa Peace Foundation, I'd like to thank Friends of Europe for collaborating with us in organizing this important event. Secondly, I also would like to express our appreciation to Ms. Shada Islam, Director of Policy of Friends of Europe, for initiating this collaboration. Thirdly, we are also grateful to the panelists. And last but not the least, we are also thankful to other friends of Muslim Democrats Project who are present in this event today. Ms. Khalid Jafar, Executive Director, Institute of Policy Studies, and Mr. Mohammad Laimi Abdul Zaim, President of Malaysia Muslim Youth Movement. Ladies and gentlemen, the idea of Muslim Democrats was proposed by the Honorable Dato Sri Anwar Ibrahim, former Deputy Prime Minister and the leader of the People's Justice Party in Malaysia in 2013. Because that idea was consistent to our mission for effectively promoting activities, proposals, and exchange in the search for the new governance model for human society, the Sasagawa Peace Foundation has collaboratively launched an initiative to promote Muslim Democrat with the Habibie Center in Indonesia, Institute for Policy Studies in Malaysia, and the Foundation of Political, Economic, and Social Research in Turkey in April 2014. Consequently, this initiative has established a common platform known as the World Forum for Muslim Democrats for the purpose of developing a network of leaders, intellectuals, and professionals from the Islamic faith together with their counterparts from other faiths and persuasions to articulate their progressive views on matters pertaining to freedom, democracy, justice, and development. This movement defined Muslim Democrats as, among other things, a Muslim who values peace and democracy, freedom and dignity, tolerance and inclusiveness, regardless of national, political, social, and cultural differences. Needless to say, Islam and the liberal democracy is not a new discourse for the Muslims and non-Muslims world. The question that has been relentlessly asked is, can Islamic beliefs and principles accommodate liberal democracy that preserves universal suffrage, liberty, and equality, government of the people, by the people, and for the people? In my opinion, the answer to this question are not easy to derive, and that is why we are meeting here today to discuss Muslim Democrats. Although I think not all Muslims could give a unified answer to this question, but I could also observe that there are glimpses of optimism. The development and the modernization process of Turkey, the peaceful democratic transformation of Indonesia, and the most recent election result in Tunisia are three good examples of how liberal democratic system can be established in the Muslim world. Skeptics might say that there are merely three out of the 56 countries in the Organization of Islamic Cooperation, but I believe that these three countries have shown that Islam is constructive to the development of liberal democracy. You may be quite curious to know that why a Japanese private foundation is involved in supporting the promotion of Muslim Democrats. It is quite easy to imagine that homogeneous but pluralistic orientation of Japanese society isolate Japanese people from challenges faced by the Muslim world. However, in my opinion, this is not the case for at least two reasons. First, the lack of understanding in Islam can be the potential cause of Islamophobia in Japan. Hence, it is of utmost importance to enhance the understanding of Islam in Japan for the promotion of Muslim Democrats. Second, liberal democratic system did not take root in Japan overnight. There were painstakingly years of many decades for the Japanese people to establish, to cultivate, and strengthen their own liberal democracy. Because of their overall experience, and also because of Japanese respect to all religions, I believe Japan can still contribute constructively to the Muslim world in their quest to establish a liberal democratic system that are inspired by Islamic belief and principles. It is in this context that Sasagawa Foundation is working very closely with the collaborators of the World Forum for the Muslim Democrats. I hope that this effort will inspire a bigger leap for all the people concerned, regardless of whether they are Muslims or non-Muslims like us. And in this spirit, I look forward to a very lively discussion in this panel. So I should stop here. Thank you very much for listening.
Thank you very much, Marie, for giving us a very forward-looking approach that SPF has adopted through the years. And promoting the understanding of the diversity of Islam is also something that is very, very essential in Europe, especially in these rather dark and difficult days. So thank you very much indeed for this introduction. I'm going to kick off the panel now, and actually I'm going to turn to you, Nurul. You are the politician on this panel. So what is... Really, just a basic question, what is a Muslim Democrat? How do you define it? What do you do? What do you guys do that is so different from normal Democrats?
Thank you, Shada, for the invitation. Of course, I'd just like to extend my warmest to the members of our panel, predominantly women, Ima, Paazra, as well as Merte. Ladies and gentlemen, peace to all. I think I wanted to start with the famous statement, which perhaps was often referred to when people think about Muslim Democrats. Rashid Ghannouchi, the president of ENAHDA, stated openly in the recent conference that they had, we're not Islamists, we're Muslim Democrats. Therefore, sort of clarifying the decision taken by their party to separate the religious advocacy wing from the political activity. So for us, I come from the multiracial and multi-religious People's Justice Party in Malaysia. It was set up in 1999 by Anwar Ibrahim. And even though Malaysia is populated by 60% Muslims, majority Muslims, we've had the government utilizing race and religion in its politics, parties based on ethnicities. But the decision was taken to ensure that we promote diversity and we give encouragement for Muslims who are working within the ambit of a democratic system. You must remember that at the end of the day, our federal constitution is described by many academics as secular in outlook. So things like promoting human rights, freedom of expression, free and fair elections, freedom of the media. I think these are basic parameters. And we, as Muslim Democrats, because we're not really the majority right now, and with the way everything that's happening, I think it's important to lend a strong identity, to also promote that this effort actually is part and parcel as being vanguards against any trends of illiberalism. So for me, from the Malaysian experience, from the very beginning, we had leaders talking about issues such as the creation of an Islamic state, but involving non-Muslims in the discussion. And I think that's why it's so powerful, it's so important, because it addresses the larger problem of diversity. I mean, it's not a problem, my point is the reality that's faced in the world today. And when we mention Muslim Democrat, Anwar Ibrahim specifically started this trend, and with the help of Sasakawa Peace Foundation and Today Friends of Europe, to ask that all Muslim Democrats who are fighting for liberal democracy unite and make sure their voices are heard loud and clear.
So are you basically, Nurul, saying what the Tunisians have just said from another party, that you're going to take the party out of the mosque?
Again, I'm not Rashid Ghannouchi. I just mentioned the quote because it was perhaps the most recent statement when you hear Muslim Democrat. But I think it is, I mean, I attended the conference. From what I heard, ENAHDA realizes, first and foremost, they have to embrace a constitution which is made up of agreement and support from all groups, diverse groups, one. Number two, the fact of the matter is, if any leader in their party decides to continue their work in mosques, then they would have to resign from the Shura Council. Mm. I think to make sure the focus should be in the politics, promoting the party per se, but also giving the freedom, again, you know, to different groups. If you talk about the Christian democratic model, I think it's quite similar, but it's really also very refreshing because I feel they are actually espousing the zeitgeist of the moment.
Right. We will talk about Tunisia tomorrow morning at our peace conference in the morning as well tomorrow. So let me go now to Professor. Thank you very much, Nurul. I'll come back to you about certain issues you've brought up. Professor Azra, so the Indonesian President Gus Dur, who was also an Islamic scholar, referred to a crisis of misunderstanding about Islam. He also talked about restoring the honor of Islam in the face of desecration by extremists. You yourself, Professor Azra, have made comments of the need to have a new narrative, an Indonesian-based narrative or a Southeastern Asia-based narrative on Islam. Explain a little bit.
Yes, I agree with Gus Dur, of course. I think to a great extent, part of the crisis is actually created by Muslims themselves. I think many Muslim countries fail to clean the house, you know, to make their houses in order. So you can observe some of the Muslim countries are on the edge of failed state. So that's why you have millions, I don't know, not million, probably 100,000 migrants coming from Middle East because of the failure of the state. And part of the problem are created by Muslim themselves, by the regime in the Middle East. We are very fortunate in Southeast Asia, we don't have influx of migrants from Malaysia or from Indonesia, coming to Australia or to Japan or to Europe, for instance. Of course, Indonesia and Malaysia are not perfect. Yeah? We still have problem with our democracy. But for Indonesia, we are very proud of being, of being able to make Islam compatible with democracy. I think this is because Indonesia is blessed by God with the existence of dynamic and vibrant Islamic-based civil society. And of course, you mentioned Gus Dur, and Gus Dur was the national leader of Nahdlatul Ulama, the revival of the Ulama that was established in 1926, long time ago. And Gus Dur was elected as a president during the transition from more than three decades of Suharto's power. And, the role of Islamic-based civil society is very, very important because they can provide alternative leadership during the time of political turbulence, like between politicians on the one hand and military, TNI, on the other hand. And Gus Dur, again, was the leader of NU, and then military could not refuse, yeah, could not oppose Gus Dur when President Abdurrahman Wahid ordered Indonesian military to return to the barrack. So again, the role of Islamic-based civil society is very important. This is very unfortunate that this kind of civil society is conspicuously absent in the Middle East. What you have, for instance, in Egypt, is only military on the one hand and politician, Ikhwan, Muslim Brotherhood on the other. No middle power, no mediating power, no bridging power. So that's the problem. So if you want to, let's say, to strengthen, to consolidate democracy, and then you have to have, first, of course, vibrant civil society. Secondly, freedom of press. I think Indonesia, one of the most free freedom of press. You can criticize sometimes, president in the media, no problem in Indonesia. So
right.
I think we are very very fortunate to have a big, this Islamic-based civil society.
So you're talking about Nadlatul Ulama, NU, with 50 million members and one of the most influential Islamic organizations in Indonesia. But I want to probe you a little bit on an interview, Professor, that you gave recently to an American newspaper in which you talked about religious racism in the Middle East. And your feeling was that there is such a prejudice in the Arab world that only Arabs can be Muslims. So how can, in the face of such arrogance, quote-unquote, can non-Arab countries reclaim or claim to be Muslims?
The term religious racism is not actually coming from myself. I took it from one of my professor who was at the time ambassador to Egypt, and he wrote a very important tafsir, Quranic exegesis. He said one of the a number of Arab ulama said that his tafsir, his Quranic exegesis, is not real tafsir. Even though the writer of this the Mufassir, the author of this tafsir, graduated summa cum laude from Azhar University, but still he's not considered as a real Mufassir. So this is what I call as a religious racism. The term religious racism is not from him, but from me. But this is the problem. As if the real Muslim are only the Arabs. While, of course, there are many academic, scientific study comparing, for instance, the loyalty of Muslim to prayer five times a day, for instance. As early as 1986, a UCLA professor named Nikki Keddie conducted research in Jakarta, Tehran, and Cairo, comparing Muslim in which city is are more loyal to prayer five times a day, and she found that the Muslim in Jakarta more loyal regularly. And Malaysia, of course, I think now we are going to have Ramadan in the next week. Next week, I think if you come to Jakarta, if you come to Indonesia, or also to Malaysia, I think Ramadan is very special time in this part of the world. It's very noisy. Also, of course, if you watch TV, almost 24 hours a day, you can watch the Islamic programs. Of course, in Indonesia, any religion can preach the religion on TV. Not in Malaysia, because in Malaysia, Islam is the official religion of federation. While in Indonesia, Islam is not official religion of the state, nor Islam is the basis of the state. We have what we call as a deconfessional basis of the state called Pancasila, five pillars. Hmm. Deconfessional has nothing to do with any religion. So that's the difference between Indonesia and Malaysia.
Yes, and thank you very much for insisting on the difference. I think it's important for our conversation today. Ima, so we've had the politician, we've had the Islamic scholar, now I want the think tank point of view. So is the Muslim Democrat narrative, this focus on tolerance and inclusivity, is it really challenging the Wahhabi extremist narrative and the IS narrative, which is even worse, if you like? Is there a potential for a real counter narrative here?
Thank you very much, Shada. A good evening to everyone. Assalamu alaikum warahmatullahi wabarakatuh as well. I think yes, because the thing is, the counter narrative is one that is peaceful. You mentioned it, and Amari mentioned it, and Iza also mentioned that, the Islam that we're trying to put forward, that is to counter ISIS and to counter the Wahhabi, is one that promotes human rights, promotes equality, promotes the role of women, and I think, with a population that. Women have being the larger population in most countries, it's something that, you know, that people are embracing. I think, you know, it is definitely for me, in my opinion, it is a counter narrative, because the brand of Islam that ISIS and the Wahhabi Islam as well is promoting is one that is limiting. It doesn't embrace diversity. And when you don't embrace the diversity, you're not embracing the reality of our societies. Indonesia is Prof. Azra already mentioned, Indonesia is a very diverse country, and as is Malaysia and a lot of Southeast Asian countries who have a majority Muslim population. So for me, it's definitely a counter narrative, not only because we promote the values, which happen to also be the values of democracy, but it's also values that are inclusive. It doesn't promote violence. The brand of Islam that ISIS is trying to put out is, if you don't agree with the ways, with our way, it's no way, you know. And they regard killing, they regard violence as something that is condoned and that is something that is acceptable. And I don't think that's acceptable in the world that we live in now. In any world that we live in, I don't think violence should be condoned. And for me, that's definitely one. I mean, the brand that we're, you know, of the Muslim Democrats that we're trying to promote and that we're trying to push forward is that again respects human rights, respects equality, and pushes that forward.
That's the talk.
Yes.
That's the principles. Yes. Those are the values. Mm-hmm. Ima, in practice, does that happen?
It does happen. In Indonesia, it does happen. And again, that's why I'm not sure. I can't speak for my colleagues from the Middle East on why they don't accept that the Middle East, that Islam can exist outside of the Middle East and can exist in Indonesia. Islam has existed in Indonesia and has thrived and in the way that we have practiced it. It has been practiced. Women have had a role, and we still, are faithful to the religion. We have Islamic scholars. We have, you know, Professor Azra is one of the best ones, but one of many Islamic scholars in Indonesia, and we have had presidents who are, are very democratic. President Habibie, who established the Habibi Center, was seen as the first democratic president in 50 years in Indonesia. And he promoted democracy. He promoted the role of women. Right. And he promoted, he was the one that set up a commission for protection of women's rights and equality. And he freed the press. So it's those things that I think really matter. We put it into practice. Yes, we have our problems in Indonesia.
But you do have problems.
Oh, yeah, we do have problems.
Attacks on minorities, burning of churches.
Yes.
Attacks on Ahmadiyyas.
We have those as well. But also, but those are the challenges that we're facing. Like any other democracy, we're also facing groups who are not happy about the situation. Who are trying to push their political interests forward. And some of them, use the banner of Islam. Unfortunately, use the banner of Islam. But I think a lot of them also are just purely common, criminals who are trying to promote something that should not be labeled as Islam.
So they're taken to court, they're judged. I mean, it's all criminal activity.
Well,
is treated
I think
as such.
This is what I think should happen, and in some parts, yes, it's happening. But these are people who are putting using the banner of Islam and vandalizing minority houses or houses of worship of other religions, and they should be treated as criminals because that is against the constitution. Mm-hmm. It's against the principles that Indonesia has. Professor Azra mentioned Pancasila, and it's something that Pancasila has been embraced and it was put forward by our forefathers, and it's the principles that we hold dearly in Indonesia. And I think what we need right now in Indonesia as we progress in our democracy and democratic development is actually embrace again those same values of Pancasila, of respecting diversity.
So the struggle is a constant one, in a sense, against the forces of extremism, etc. So thank you very much. I'll come back to the question later on, but I think we have a number of people who are really interested in the topic, and I want to give them the floor as well. But Marietta, I want to come to you. So, I've lived and worked here for decades, and Ever through these years, the focus of it's on. The focus of the European Union when it talks about Islam really is on the Arab world. And once in a while we talk about Iran and once in a while about Turkey, but when you hear our panelists and you hear about the diversity and the pluralism there is there, does it make you think that there should be more of an engagement with the world outside the Arab world?
Thank you, Sharda, and thank you for
a bit closer
for inviting me. If there's anything wrong with the panel, it's not. It's a one-man panel. It's more that it's experts and then someone else. I say that because it's true what Sharda just hinted at is I am working on religion, and very often that is a synonym for working on Islam and focus with a focus on the Arab world. Our work is, however, also on other religions than just Islam. We're working also on looking at getting to a more granular understanding of Hinduism, Buddhism, also in their political expressions. And we do try to focus on the world outside the MENA region. And we do. We do engage with the full spectrum of the political landscape, also in countries like Indonesia and Malaysia. And HRVP Mogherini is just back from a visit to Indonesia, which really brought in some precisely fresh ideas as to should we not try to give the microphone to a different Islam than the one that we often hear. The question is, as it's the title of a book by John Esposito, who speaks for Islam, who gets to say what good Islam is and what is it we listen to? We have a tendency to hold up the microphone to a very small minority of very violent, destructive individuals, and we miss the global picture, including what we see in Southeast Asia. Having said that, I think from what I hear, I think it's interesting to hear this, you know, Muslim Democrats, it's nothing dissimilar from normal Democrats, and that's how we should be working at it. That has pretty much also been our line, saying that we need to engage with the full spectrum of the political landscape, regardless of conservatism, liberal, Islamist, secular, etc., etc. The red line is condoning violence as a political means. So we do try to see it as a way to make sure that we get the full picture. Now, there has been ups and downs, and especially when you look at the Arab world today, we are very often told by our Arab friends, this is not the moment to look at that, we need something else. But our line remains the same, and I think it's important to stress that we may adapt the way we do it, but we don't adapt on the principle. I do see the challenges of focusing and working more closely and trying to bridge over or bring back in some of the models that may be specific to your region and may be very difficult to export elsewhere, but at least to be aware of them. And I think the fact that Mogherini came back so enthusiastic has given sort of a jolt to their system to do precisely that.
Right. And in terms of the debate that we're having now in Europe about the young Muslims in Europe that are moving towards more extremist ideas, sometimes even going as foreign fighters, I mean, do you think there is a message here that could be valuable to these, I could say, lost generation?
I think this is a very touchy issue, and that's why it's always very good to report yourself back to evidence, to those who've studied it and who don't just belong to the group of talking heads who offer their expertise here, there, and everywhere. We see that the young foreign fighters from European countries, so very different from the foreign fighters you have from your region or for Tunisia or from Saudi Arabia, et cetera, they tend to be radicalized before they become religious. I mean, many of them are Muslims, either originally or convertees, but That's not the trigger effect. And I say that bearing in mind there's a huge debate raging out there whether, you know, we should focus more on Islam and bringing good Islam in, et cetera, et cetera. If it so happens that these people are motivated by a plethora of different factors, and we then end up only focusing about Islam and religion, we actually make it more about religion than we need to do. So we need to make sure that we right-size the role of it. It's not to apologize. We need to acknowledge that there are some real issues within Islam today. But these issues need to be fixed by people who have credibility, authenticity, who can find some organically homegrown solutions to this. And there we are paying attention to the various initiatives that are mushrooming up, both in your part of the world, but also nearer to home. And I think that's also part of why we may or may not be guilty of looking always to the air, to the Arab world, simply because of geographical proximity, and maybe also they're very good at pushing, being more vocal than maybe the case is from your part of the wood.
Right, so I think what's important is to have a diversity of views and interpretation and to acknowledge their existence. Please, Nurul.
Sorry, because I heard the term foreign fighters, and I think it's very crucial when Merte mentioned going back to the data. And basically, there was a report came up from the USAID as well as the Sufan Group report. Guess which country has the least number of foreign fighters flying to the Daesh and the Iraqi regions? It's Indonesia. So it's really interesting to see the world's most populous Muslim country actually having the least number of fighters. And Sydney Jones attributed this...
Human Rights Watch.
Well, she's also an analyst, an academic, but she basically attributed it because in Indonesia, again, I'm borrowing her words here, Pak Azra, there's no sense of, the least sense of being marginalized. The stakeholders have relatively adequate space to sort of formulate legitimate political dissent. And of course, the presence of the civil society, Nadata Ulama, as mentioned by Pak Azra and Muhammadiyah, also is very pivotal. Malaysia, in contrast, has six times more per capita foreign fighters. And of course, it's a major concern for us. And again, we keep stating, when you allow governments to train their guns on legitimate political dissent, it takes away the focus from actually addressing the root causes of terrorism and terrorists themselves. So I think it's really an important bit to look at Indonesia. Can you imagine this? We're talking about something that's impressive, a breakthrough. Of course, as Merte mentioned, doesn't mean that everyone needs to follow Indonesia's model, but it has to be looked at more closely.
I think overall 700 Indonesian foreign fighters out of a population of 180 million, sorry.
Can I add something?
Please.
Yeah, according to the chief police, I met on the airplane with the Indonesian chief police, Badruddin Haiti, a few days ago. I asked him about the number of Indonesian going to ISIS. He said 458. Yeah, 458. Of course, when David Cameron came to Indonesia last year, I was among five Indonesian figures to see him, to have a dialogue, conversation with him. He said that we are in the UK, have something like 2.5 million Muslim, but those who join ISIS, more than 2,000. While in Indonesia, you have 250 million people, and those who join ISIS is around 500. This is what he said, around 500. Of course, the number is not correct. But again, I think David Cameron said that we need to learn from you, from Indonesia. How do you prevent, young Muslim going in big number to ISIS? Of course, one of the key for Indonesia is what we call as Wasatiyah Islam, Middle Path Islam, that, Khairul Umur Awsatwa, this is the hadith. The best, matters is on the middle path. So NU, if you talk about NU Muhammadiyah, and many other Muslim organizations in Indonesia, they represent Wasatiyah Islam, middle path Islam. So that's why, you know, and of course this Wasatiyah Islamic organization have a very strong, you know, base up to the grassroots level. Yeah.
Right. Thank you very much. I'd like to open the floor now. There's some very knowledgeable people out there, so, and I'm sure at least my Arab friends will perhaps have questions about all we've been saying about how you need to seize it from the Arab Peninsula and give it to other people. So I already have Mohammed's hand up. Is there anyone else? And Nuruddin? And okay, so all the journalists are out there putting up their hands. Very good. I have a roving microphone. Could you, may I make a plea? And Mohammed, this applies to you too. Mohammed, the plea is for brevity. I want to have an interactive discussion, so please be brief in your comments.
Thank you very much. I can't agree with what you said about racism against non-Arab Muslims. When we were in school,
Mohammed, can you introduce yourself, please, very quickly?
Mohammed Reza Ibarakat. I am from Palestinian origin. Well, at school in Jordan, all Arab countries, we used to study that the biggest Islamic country is non-Arab country. And when we speak about Arab world, we speak also about Islamic world. And I don't think that, and we give the example of Indonesia, Malaysia as economy successfully, economic, they succeeded economically. And well, I can't agree with what you said about that. You are, you know, when I remember Arab countries, because now you represent Indonesia and Malaysia as modern Islamic or democratic countries. When I remember Arab countries before the Arab Spring or 20 years ago, we had, and I discussed that with my friend Nuruddin here, we had a modern Islam. We used to have modern Islam. And for Miss, you spoke that we have a problem with Islam in Europe. We don't have a problem with Islam in Europe. We have problem with some Muslims in Europe. I think it's important to notice that. And you know why we have problems with some Muslims in Europe? For geopolitical reasons, for wars against Arab countries, for lying, you know, many European and American responsibles lied about Arab countries, the destruction, yeah, the arms, the weapons, the,
yeah,
which has not
list.
Existed,
right.
And all such things.
Thanks,
thank
Mohammed.
You very much.
Thank you. Nuruddin, do you want to ask your question now too? And then I'll turn to the panel.
Good afternoon. I'm Nuruddin Fridi. I'm Tunisian. I'm the bureau chief of Arabian News Channel, but my intervention here is just as a Tunisian and as a journalist and as a citizen in this country. My question is mainly to our Asian Muslim Democrats friends, and mainly to Madame Nurul Izza Anwar, because she mentioned the latest statement of Rashid Al-Ghannouchi, the leader of another political, another Islamist party in Tunis, in Tunisia, suggesting that now they stop to run the political Islam. Now Mr. Rashid Al-Ghannouchi and his political party is a Muslim Democrat party. Any Tunisian would welcome this statement, but before telling you that we seculars, let's say, or even some non-seculars, we have much doubt about the sincerity of the statement of these people, even if you can say that I'm judging his intention and it's not the right place here. But one relevant point, Shada, is that it's because of the fight of the civil society, because of the resistance of women organizations, trade unions, universities, journalists, seculars, and they realized Rashid Al-Ghannouchi and his political Islam party realized that they cannot go ahead in the framework of the Tunisian society. So in the case of our society, I think it's thanks to the civil society resistant to the political Islam of Mr. Rashid Al-Ghannouchi and his friends that he realized that now he has to behave as a Muslim, a Democrat or right. a Democrat Muslim, and anybody can welcome welcome that. I have just one question, Shaddai, if I may. Can you explain to us all possible political, intellectual, religious connections or common ground between the Muslim brotherhoods in the Arab countries and the Asian Muslim Democrats?
If there's a connection?
Yes.
Okay, good. Because and your first question was about civil society's influence.
No, just the point for our Asian, but also our European colleagues, that this is not about Mr. Rashid, the Muslim, the political Islam in the Arab world evolving, changing because it's becoming Democrats, but it's changing because it's forced to change by the civil society in Tunisia.
Yeah.
Thank you.
You'll have to excuse us a little bit. We can't hear everything very well, so may I ask all the speakers to hold the microphone really close to their mouth. I'm going to turn to the panel to answer these two questions, and then I'm going to come here because your hands were up, and then I'll go back. I've seen everyone's hand. It will be done. Please.
Okay, maybe I'll start first. In terms of the first question, I can't hear everything completely, but I think what I can rectify is I'm not claiming that Malaysia is a model democratic nation. I think we have a lot of weaknesses. A lot of my colleagues, for example, have a travel ban imposed on them for merely criticizing corruption and, of course, cronyism in Malaysia. So certainly it's a work in progress. I can go on and on, but today is not about a forum about Malaysia. So I think it's crucial to understand these are successful examples that give us hope that things can actually improve. And I mentioned Tunisia because perhaps in the Middle East, from a Malaysian perspective, again, with all due respect, it is perhaps the most successful the experience in the Arab. A lot of people scold me for saying Arab Spring. They say it's more like an Arab earthquake because imagine the sort of the suffering and difficulty they had to face throughout the whole process. So yes, certainly these are examples for us to share and for us to basically ask in this happenings that's taking place, in the refugee crisis, Malaysia and Indonesia are also facing the plight of the Rohingyas, the boat people. I think it's a major problem that was faced by ASEAN some months ago. So I would not say that we've handled it perfectly. Many boat people have died. We've also been accused of being very insensitive, very cruel in some of the management. That's important. Now, second, when I went for the Ennahda conference, one of the things that struck me was this. The President FCC came and he spoke. Can you imagine just during the elections, these are two different entities attacking one another. And yet for the Ennahda conference, the President came. And usually in Malaysia, if you have politicians from the other side, there'll be some booing. That's quite the norm. But I actually heard some shouting in French, in Arab, sorry. And I said, what is he saying? He's saying, I love you, Mr. President, I love you. So coming from Ennahda delegates. And I must remind everyone here, of course, it's still a process. It's a transitional process. And a lot of things has to take place. And mind you, the fact that President Ghannouchi made that statement, I completely agree, is not just about being ingenious, it's also being partly pragmatic through the pressures of civil society. And every political party needs that. You have to have pressure groups. And why I commend them? Because they're not playing deaf. They're actually listening to the pressure groups and other stakeholders. Because mind you, there's many political parties that can continue to be deaf for years. And my final point is, when you talk about the similarity, I think we have here the president of the Islamic Youth Movement of Malaysia. We did not make a bai'ah, a loyalty to the Muslim Brotherhood. I think it's quite important to understand Malaysia's experiences is very unique. We have a very different impression of the Brotherhood. Yes, we condemn the coup, but the similarities stop, and we've had to go through our own different types of challenges in the past. So I would say that, yes, we were very much influenced by the Iranian Revolution, But again, when the Children of the Revolution became victims, of course, then we had to go on our own political transition.
Right.
Thank you for helping me at least clarify that.
Professor, would you like to?
Yeah, 2 years ago, I was arranged, actually the Indonesian ambassador here in Brussels arranged a meeting. I visited Brussels at the time and then arranged a meeting with imams and Muslim leaders in Brussels. And of course, they complained about the increased tension because of, the rise of Islamophobia or something like that. I said, there are at least two major root causes of Islamophobia in Europe. The first of course, economic downturn because economic crisis, and then some rightist politicians blame migrants, particularly Muslims, of this economic crisis. Secondly, because of lack of sensitivity among Muslims. I said that in Indonesia, we have a local wisdom called stating that di mana bumi dipijak, di situ langit dijunjung. Meaning, when you are in Rome, do what the Romans do. Yeah? So you have to be sensitive to local culture, to local people. Yeah? As a migrant, you have to be adaptive to local culture. You should not bring your, custom from somewhere, somewhere in the Muslim world. Yeah? So,
Professor, what about the connection with the Brotherhood? The question about...
Okay, yeah. So you have to be sensitive to local culture in order to get accepted by local people. So this is one. Second one about Tunisia. Tunisia is now the only hope for democracy to grow in the Arab world. I was in Tunisia, invited by Institute Tunisian, the Etude Strategiques, talking about, exchanging best practices of democracy. Of course, we Indonesian do not want to teach others, particularly other Muslim, how to be democrats. But we simply want to exchange our experience in democracy. So I think the problem with Tunisia now, of course, continued violence. Of course, Rashid Ghannouchi. Now has become more accommodative to secular parties, but at the same time, you still have bombs, shootings in resort areas. I stay in 400 hotel, but there were only 40 rooms that have guests.
Sure.
Can you imagine the economic growth? So you cannot talk about democracy unless your economy is growing.
That's one of the messages of our conference tomorrow as well. Khaled, could you bring the microphone here in front to Khaled Farouki? Or Fabio, please. Please just briefly introduce yourself. I'll give you the others the floor as well as we go on.
Khaled Hamid Farouki, I'm a journalist, correspondent of Jio Television and Jang Group of Newspaper, Pakistan here. And Pakistanis take great interest in Malaysian politics in particular, and we have gone through all episode of Anwar Ibrahim, your father, how your family gone through, and I greatly appreciate that you emerge from out of that struggle. So you are politician in your own right. But it is surprising for me that your source of inspiration is Nahda or Rashid Ghannouchi. If you know in Tunisia, and my friend did not maybe throw some light on Tunisian constitution before Nahda came into power, Islamists came into power, it was one of the most progressive woman-friendly constitution in Islamic world. And what's happening in, you must be watching, but is it really essential and is it not a poisonous in multicultural society to form political parties on the basis of religion which represent it is large number of people living in Malaysia are not Muslim. So there is, it is surprising for me to people form parties on the basis of religion. And this is always divisive political agenda it has. Why you have party on the basis of religion? And why, and my questions to professor, that Middle Islam, of your experience of Middle Islam, is really working, or there is also Al-Qaeda affiliate in your country, and a lot of Al-Qaeda activity have been there, and a lot of terrorists also emerged from there. So it is really generally Muslim, this ideology of Islamism, political Islam, is really fatal to the modernity and the progress and development, don't you think so? It is not only Middle Islam or moderate Islam or extremist Islam. So this is the ideology itself.
Yeah, thanks, Khaled. So basically drop the Muslim appellation. I'll just give you the floor in a second. So the question was, why are you getting inspired from... I don't think you are being inspired, so I think just clarify that.
Maybe I shouldn't start with Ganushi next time around when I come to Europe. Because I just came, I just attended a conference, and of course everyone wants to hear more good news from Middle East. But to say it's an inspiration, we're happy with the outcome, but I think the inspiration is more on how we came to be as far back as 17 years ago. Why Anwar Ibrahim chose the newly formed political party in the wake of the Reformasi movement in Malaysia to be one, not based on religion, but one that's multi-religious and multi-racial. That was a brave step. And today we are probably the most successful party, and we've won in governing two state governments, the richest in Malaysia. So certainly it is not something I would say reflects our current thinking. Additionally, in Malaysia, it's very sad because we have official religious agencies, the vanguards of religion that describes what is acceptable or not, and also, of course, Islamic parties. Yeah, and the main Islamic party and the way discourse has been controlled, and the fact that religion as well as race is intertwined very heavily in the narrative of the government, have led us into being stuck, mired in this pathetic narrative which belongs 30 years ago. That's why I mentioned for a country like Tunisia, Malaysia is much richer, okay? But Tunisia can say bye-bye to Islamism and embrace a more post-Islamic approach, shall we say, okay? But in Malaysia, we're still stuck in the discussion, Islamic State, Hudud Bill. You know, for me, why? Because of political expediency, partly. Yeah. So all these things, again, I will not be able to explain the context of how it is in Malaysia, but I would say our commitment, my commitment as a Muslim Democrat, is to make sure the laws in my country, democracy in my country, is being practiced as stipulated in the federal constitution. Yeah. In this particular outlook.
Right. So Muslim Democrats are not in power in many parts of the world. Let's put it modestly like that. Ima, do you want to come in? Okay. The gentleman, yes, I have two hands going up there, an ambassador, then yourself. Yes, please. Welcome to Brussels.
Bonsoir, je vais parler en français.
Vous parlez en français. Aujourd'hui, on n'a pas de traduction. Donc, je vais traduire. Allez-y. Alors vous devez être un peu court parce que
je suis court, mais mais j'ai quelques remarques. J'ai quand même trois ou quatre remarques.
Vous pouvez vous introduire juste rapidement.
Je suis Ali Zidini, vice-président de la Ligue tunisienne des droits de l'homme. J'interviendrai demain pour parler de l'expérience tunisienne, mais aujourd'hui je vais juste faire quelques remarques. Il y a qui vont en quelque sorte dans le sens de ce qui a été dit. Mais il y a certains points, certaines remarques qui m'ont interpellé et j'ai voulu réagir. D'abord pour le titre, l'islam et le défi des démocrates musulmans. À mon avis, même pour le titre, j'ai un problème avec le titre.
Okay.
Moi, en tant que Tunisien.
D'accord. Le titre, c'est pour vous attirer. Continuez, s'il vous plaît.
Parce qu'on ne peut pas parler de démocrates musulmans comme de démocrates chrétiens, comme de juifs... démocrate comme de même et puis est-ce qu'on peut parler de monde musulman puisque j'ai entendu parler de monde musulman sans faire vraiment la différence entre chaque région de ce monde de musulman et sans même insister sur les spécificités. Moi je vous dis que il y a rien de commun entre le mode de vie des Tunisiens et celui des Saoudiens. La femme tunisienne qui a eu le droit à l'interruption volontaire de la grossesse depuis 1956 n'a rien à voir avec la femme saoudienne qui n'a pas le droit de conduire une voiture. Donc, si on parle de structure, on fait abstraction des spécificités.
Oui, tout à fait.
Des spécificités
Monsieur, le troisième point, parce que je dois traduire aussi, hein, donc ça me prendra du temps. Oui. Rapidement, le dernier point, s'il vous plaît.
Non,
parce que je vais juste
évoquer deux remarques, parce que ça a été dit, parce qu'on a beaucoup parlé de M. Rachid Ghannouchi et de l'exemple tunisien.
Oui.
Or, je trouve que, parce que ce qui a été fait en Tunisie n'a rien à voir avec cette simplification de Rachid Ghannouchi. D'ailleurs, mon ami tunisien l'a bien évoqué. Oui. La constitution tunisienne, qui est une constitution
civile.
On a
compris ça aussi. Donc, s'il vous plaît, continuez, parce que je dois traduire. Allez-y maintenant.
Donc, je voulais juste finir par dire, pour que ça, comme ça, je ne vais pas parler, par dire qu'en Tunisie, à l'ordre du jour aujourd'hui, la question qui s'est posée, qui se pose pendant le congrès d'Annaba et après, ce n'est pas l'islam, les démocratiques et les islam. La société qui pose, le dialogue qui est posé au niveau sociétal tunisien, c'est la séparation entre la religion, entre l'islam et le politique.
Okay.
Et même pas, comme l'a posé Nahda, entre le politique et la prédication.
Merci, compris. So I'm going to be very brief. Okay. You can't talk about the Muslim world. He doesn't like the title. Fine, I chose the title, so mea culpa, I like it. Muslim world is not one, so there's very specific differences between countries, which is what we're saying, that it is not one. That's exactly our thesis and our message today. Ghannouchi is nothing to... Anyway, that we should not be looking up to Ghannouchi, basically, as a role model. I don't think any of you are. What is really needed in Tunisia today is a separation of Islam and the state. Right. I think we'll take another question, and then you can come back to these issues as well. Ambassador, please.
Oui.
Yeah, I've seen you.
Merci. Thank you very much. Disagree with my colleague from Tunisia. You know, my name is François Dadeschi. I'm Christian, but I used to live 6 years in Muslim country, specific Muslim country, you know, because they had a Sufi, means spiritual attitude, and they agree in a Sufi country for the separation between, state and religion. But my question is to the lady from Malaysia, Ms. Anwar, deputy and people representative at the parliament. I found it was very interesting your similarity between Christian Democrats and Muslims Democrats, you know. I have no problem with a party, you know, religious party, provide that the state is neutral and that you have the separation between state and religion. But having said so, I have a question. If you agree on this, and I found your similarity very interesting because it created bridge, common values, and then we can live in peace when we have common value. But my question is the following. Why so many Muslims country promote the Islamic Declaration of Human Rights instead of the Universal Declaration of Human Rights? This is my question. Thank you.
Thank you. That's a very specific question. Do you want to answer these questions now? Yeah, I will collect. So please, Khaled, please come forward for the Indonesian ambassador. Yeah.
Thank you, Sada. Good afternoon. I would like, first of all, to express my sincere appreciation to all the panelists for your all good presentations. Very interesting and useful. I think some of the keywords are misunderstanding, lack of information, Islamophobia, and then the one who are going to clap their hands is ISIS, because the more you have Islamophobia here, the better the ground for more radicalization, I think. And then reality is being defined by idea. And when we talk about idea, media and social media are very important. Media and social media can be useful in terms of promoting, understanding, or even make misunderstanding more serious. I think we need to discuss about the strategy, how to ensure that media will contribute in terms of more understanding than misunderstanding. Thank you very much.
Thank you very much. So the role of the media. Khaled Hela at the back, please. Please put up your hand again. Yeah.
Hello, my name is Hela Grishi and I'm from Tunisia. I'm a postgraduate student in Tunis. I study English literature and linguistics and civilization. And I'm here as a representative of the Young Arab Voices debate program. So basically I wanted to ask you a question about the link between the jihadi export rates and Islam. I found it quite interesting because I think the link between them is not Islam, but the economic disadvantage in Tunisia. You were just saying that you are economically more advanced than Tunisia, and I can see that the youth unemployment is tearing down the well-being of youth because they feel like they are undervalued, like they don't have a place there, and automatically they will be drawn to other radical solutions. So I also support the point of democracy being labeled as Muslim or Christian or as being trivial, because democracy is democracy, and if there is diversity in a country, as you said, and if we are all diverse and different, why do we need to put everyone under one label and oblige them to follow a certain point of view when we have homosexuals, we have Jews, we have Muslims, we have atheists, we all live together? So religion should be more like a spiritual way for each one to choose on their own instead of just forcing each other to believe something in common, you see? So and then I wanted to ask you also if you think that how to battle these backward mentalities and grassroots problems, that is economic disadvantage and the problem of mentality, that is, for example, in Tunisia, we have women rights, we have women who go to work, and we have abortion, we have all that. But there are these little nuances that you feel when you walk the street at 11.
So mindsets.
Yes, yes.
Mindsets, okay,
good. Mindsets,
yeah,
exactly.
Okay, great.
When you walk home and you don't feel safe.
Thank you, Hala, very much. Did you, gentlemen, want to have a question as well? Monsieur, do you have a question? Fabio, please. Please, can you ask it in English so everyone can understand? Yeah, thank you.
Thank you. Firstly, I would like to commend Friends of Europe for staging this one. I think it's very informative. We have only known democracy in Middle East that has failed, Libya, and at the moment we've got Syria crisis. And sorry, my name is Elliot from Zimbabwe.
Thank you.
The opposition, MDC. So Mugabe has been giving a sort of an excuse that democracy, the world is not ready for democracy because it has failed in Libya and because it's failing in Syria. So I think it is quite informative to hear you discussing success stories of Muslim democracy. My question is, are you reaching out to other Muslim countries so that you can share success stories? I know you cannot prescribe the type of democracy that you are enjoying or that you are implementing, because democracy, I believe, is scalable. Thank you.
Thank you. Thank you very much indeed. I will ask the panel now. So, Ima, let's kick off with you, and then Maretta, and then the others.
Thank you. I'm going to address that last question. Yes, we are reaching out to other countries. And again, to be also very clear about the World Forum for Muslim Democrats, yes, we are reaching out to those that have political positions, who are Democrats, who happen to be Muslims. But at the same time, we're also reaching out to like-minded people, because this is not just the prerogative or exclusive, because democracy isn't in the hands of the politicians only, isn't only the job. Promoting democracy and living up to democratic standards isn't only the job of politicians. So it is a job of a lot of, of a lot of different sectors, which is why the Habibi Center is involved. We're an independent think tank, but we continue to promote this because we believe that these are values and these are issues that need to be that need to be pushed forward. So for us, we don't only reach out to Muslim Democrats in the countries where our network is currently reaching out. But we're also looking, for example, we're hoping to have a partner from Africa. I have a very good friend in Nigeria who's, again, like-minded people who want to promote this because they realize that this is perhaps one of the roads to development. They definitely go hand in hand. That's my true belief, that it is something that go hand in hand. And again, in Indonesia, I think there was a mention of why Islamic political parties. In Indonesia, we have parties who promote themselves as Muslim political parties. But in Indonesia, from the very beginning, we've now experienced democracy since Reformasi for 18 years now. And from the beginning, in 1999, when we had our first ever democratic elections and political parties were formed, one of the things that they put as a criteria was it cannot be exclusive parties. It cannot be just, it can't be ethnic-based, it can't be religious-based, it had to be based on Pancasila. And at the same time, it also had to be it had to be inclusive. So you couldn't have just an all Javanese party. You couldn't just have an all, because they would win, basically. And you couldn't just have an all Sumatran party it couldn't be based. And because we realized that having those types of parties, and again, it was insight of those that were in transition, in power in transition, that you couldn't have those type. Those that will divide Indonesia more. So all the parties were based on the principle that Professor Azra mentioned earlier, the five principles of Pancasila, which is very inclusive, which starts with belief in one God, but it doesn't specify which religion. So for us in Indonesia, it is something that, you know, that we don't want to necessarily teach other countries, because that's not what we're here to do, but we want to find like-minded people who then can help us to promote this, and as well to see where we can move forward and work with people, individuals like Iza, and again our friends in the Middle East who might share. We're not excluding the Middle East completely. This is not this is not the Asian panel, and the World Forum for Muslim Democrats isn't an anti-Middle East it isn't. It is basically saying, I mean, if we can identify individuals in any country who prescribe to the principles that we've mentioned, then we would definitely be open to having discussions with them, because I think that's the only way we can function.
Can you take up the question of the media that the ambassador raised?
The issue of media. It's very easy to blame the media, Bayuri, and I actually agree with you. It's very easy to blame the media, but it's also the way that we need to move forward is to embrace and work with the media, work hand in hand with the media. Unfortunately, you can't. I mean, regulating the media is a thing of the past, because you can't. In Indonesia, you can't.
You've got bloggers. You've got bloggers, exactly. Yeah.
Media is. I mean, news is like toothpaste. Once it's out of the tube, you can't stuff it back in. And so in Indonesia, it's using the media as a counter. Yes. I think, you know, there's so many bloggers out there that spew hate, but at the same time, if we counter that with those that have positive messages, I think we'll somehow overcome that. And again, embracing those social media influencers, it's something that we've been trying to do as well. There are social media influencers who are regarded and as idols to the younger generation who are on social media, who are on 24/7 on their phones, looking at Twitter and Instagram and everything. But using that for positive, that's the only way, because restricting them is not something we want to go back to. And so I think the role of the media is one that is very, very important. We cannot continue to blame the media, because I think that just puts us in another different corner. But I think we need to start working with them to make sure that positive messages are put out there. And hopefully, talking about World Forum for Muslim Democrats, talking about Muslim Democrats, is a positive message in countering the messages that are being put out there that are leaning towards the negative. So.
Right. And one of the things that has always fascinated me about Indonesia, if I may say, is the constant confrontation or struggle for influence between the modernity and conservatism. And I think that is something that is common to many, many countries, whether they're in Asia or in the Arab world or in Africa. It's a constant struggle. And you see this very much visibly in a country that's as transparent as yours. Verite, you've had a number of questions here, and also something about mindsets from Hala, our young leader from Tunisia, about the need to change mindsets. Do you want to tackle that and others?
Yeah, I just wanted to tie on to what was just said on the importance of media. Now, the media also feeds off politicians, and politicians that stand above the fray of engaging in incitement to hatred, in building bridges or building walls. We have them all over. We need to find the champions who can go against this and make the kind of link to how can we get to stop this backrolling. People said it's work in progress, but you could also say in certain areas, including in Europe, where the state of democracy is maybe not as good as it was some years back. And that's why I think, relating to the question both from the Tunisian gentleman and the Pakistani gentleman, it's very interesting to hear how the focus on Islamist or Muslim Democrats, call them what you want, they should not be trusted, they're divisive, etc., etc. It takes two to tango. Democracy is fine, but not all Democrats are Democrats. Not all liberals are liberals. And that's why, while we look at political Islam in all its diversity, be it MB, Ennahda, FJP, Islamic Action Front, etc., etc., we need to also be aware that Islam is also used in politics by governments. And unless we have a more dynamic and fair and open-eyed view on this, I think we'll be banging the same drums as we have been banging for years, and it's not going to get us anywhere. There is a constituency out there. We just wish they all had wise leaders, as Ghannouchi. You wanted me to respond to
the mindset issue as well.
Okay, so the mindset issue is something that affects us all. It affects us also as diplomats and officials. We try very much to be sensitive to what can sometimes be an overly secular mindset. Not that we are not for a division and a clear distribution of labor, et cetera, et cetera. But we need to have a sensitivity to mindsets and modernities that are not similar to our proper experience. And we can either camp out on the secular mountain and say, this is how it's going to be, otherwise it's not democracy, or we can try to take a more informed, maybe with a little bit of historic back step, and see how could this develop. Why is it that Ghannouchi is where he is? Morsi is where he is? I just throw it out for reflection.
Thank you very much, Marita. Professor Azra, there was a reference to Sufism.
Sufism.
There was also a reference, I mean, there are repeated questions from our friends about separation of state and mosque and state and church. You know, why do we need Muslim democracies? Why do we need Christian democracies?
I think, first of all, Muslim needs more Sufism. Because Sufism makes Muslim more human, more spiritual. And with that, more accommodative, more tolerant to other people. That's why I touched upon the term Islam wasatiyah, wasatiyah Islam. Wasatiya Islam part of the three aspect of Wasatiya Islam. Is first is the third aspect is Sufism, particularly Ghazalian Sufism. So I think Muslim needs Sufism, correct Sufism, valid Sufism. If you compare it, let's say Wahhabism, Salafism, it's very dry and primitive. So that's why the very term Wahhabism is anathema. It's a dirty word for many Muslims in Indonesia. I have been asked by many journalists about the threat of Wahhabism in Indonesia or probably also in Malaysia. I said, Wahhabism cannot get, much following in Indonesia because Indonesian Muslim, probably also Malaysian Muslim, love to practice what I call as flowery Islam, colorful Islam. We love to visit graves, the tomb of our parents, particularly before Ramadan and after Ramadan, We love to have a religious gathering. We call it Kanduri in Malaysia. We call it Kanduri in Malaysia. We call it Selamatan in Indonesia. So this is, Sufism is very important. In Indonesia, the issue on the relation between state and religion has been completed long time ago. So that's why for Indonesian Muslim, Pancasila is final. Pancasila is final. The current form of Indonesian state is final. It's called Unitary State of Indonesia. And the basic principle, another basic principle of Indonesia, Bhinneka Tunggal Ika, diversity within Bhinneka means diversity. Diversity in unity is also final for Indonesian. We recognize differences among people. So there is no issue about relation between Islam and state, between secularism and thing like that. So I have another one.
Yep. Professor, while you're looking...
Oh, yeah. Yeah. About we don't have any tendency, any, pretension to export democracy, actually. I have been on the board, advisory board of Bali Democracy Forum that was established by President Susilo Bambang Yudhoyono. And we invited, many countries. We believe that there is no one single model of democracy. So you can develop your own, What is important is you have to adapt the basic principle, universal principle of democracy, like freedom of press, regular election, civil society. You have to recognize it.
Anti-corruption.
Yes, of course, good governance, things like that. Yeah, but you have to contextualize, to indigenize democracy in order to be relevant, to be meaningful in your own local cultural context. Otherwise, democracy is something imported from the West. Yeah. So I think that's last point, Shada. Just now in the morning, this afternoon before leaving my room, I saw Turkish President Erdogan condemning practice of family planning, It's not Islamic or something like that. So basically, he doesn't accept family planning. So this is a problem with modernity you mentioned. For Indonesia, again, the problem of family planning has been completed with the fatwa of the ulama in 1976 or something like that. So that's why Indonesia was very successful in terms of family planning. And many, many Muslim countries now still cannot accept family planning.
Yes, I know. Professor, I just do want to ask you to come back to the question I put in the beginning. Does Indonesia or Malaysia and the Muslim Democrats of Southeast Asia or perhaps even Asia, do they have the self-confidence the arguments that are needed to counter the IS and Wahhabi philosophy. Do you have that get up and go to do it?
I think we are very confident with this. I said Indonesian wasatia Islam is too big to fail. It's too big to fail. How do you change? Nahdlatul Ulama with 50 million members. How do you change Muhammadiyah with 40 million, with 170 universities across Indonesia? So Indonesian moderate Islam, inclusive Islam, rahmatan lil alamin, is too big to fail.
Too big to fail.
Too big to fail.
Okay. Thank you very much. Nurul.
Thanks, Shada. I just wanted to go back to what you said just now. How about action? And talking about freedom of the press, in Malaysia, 99% of the media is either directly or indirectly government-owned. So one of the things I did as a legislator, I prepared a private member's bill to abolish the existing Printing Presses and Publications Act that allows the Minister of Home Affairs to control the issuance of permit, of any publication. So certainly this regulation at work, unlike my friend here in Indonesia. Yes, President Habibi abolished all of that, but we still have it in practice. But my point is, when you have such an environment, certainly it means that Muslim Democrats have to keep fighting against these illiberal trends. And Anwar Ibrahim, my father, also the former opposition leader, has been convicted twice on sodomy. And, he's a practicing Muslim, and we, of course, basically clarified these are politically motivated convictions. But we have utilized and used the United Nations Working Group on Arbitrary Detention Mechanism. We have engaged with the European Union Parliament, parliaments across the world. So basically, Malaysia is an active player in the international fora. Every year, we will have when the time comes, the periodic review with the United Nations, and ABIM, other civil societies actually take part. So I think it would be inaccurate to say that we don't accept certain rights accorded international fora because Malaysia is an active player. And to this year marks the last year that we are the member of the Security Council, non-voting, of course. So that's one aspect. Second is the issue of, again, in terms of mindsets. Now, I was detained overnight last year, and in the lockup, I had the rare fortune of meeting a 14-year-old girl who was en route to Syria to marry off an ISIS fighter. And the police didn't know what to do with her. So they said, I know you're now a prisoner, but can you speak and advise her? Since I'm a member of parliament, I guess that gives me a pass to advise people to steer clear from terrorism. So, I was faced with this 14-year-old who's from a low-income family. But in the 1 month that she was there, so she wears a scarf. So for her, it's a very, very sort of a strong attachment to her psychological well-being. And for the 1 month, she's not allowed to wear the scarf. Okay, there's no attempts at trying to gather some intelligence to the motivations to why she felt compelled to fly overseas. She was just detained in lockup for 1 month, and the next morning, shipped to some religious schools. So for me, it's important when you look at terrorism motivations, not just to, you have to, of course, take certain measures, hard-hitting measures, but also employ a more holistic, de-radicalization, engagement, and even though some of us might not like Rashid Ghannouchi, Yusuf Qardawi, Sheikh Abdullah bin Bayah, but these are names palatable to the grassroots, certain segments. So the more statements that Ghannouchi, for example, has made, it actually addresses the stakeholders in Malaysia. I can bring John Esposito. I can bring even Obama, to fight against ISIS. ISIS is un-Islamic, but it will never be as valuable, palatable, or easily acceptable by these stakeholders. Because at the end of the day, they feel we must refer to credible scholars, and Rashid Ghannouchi ranks highly there. So I think sometimes when we want our message to resonate, despite our sentiments, our misgivings, and I'm sure, I have my own sets of feelings against certain leaders, but my point is, we want to target the audience. And that's why, unfortunately, this is how the world works. And I believe the more engagement you make, the more that message resonates and matches the speaker, the more successful we are in condemning ISIS and clarifying this is not Islam and it will never be an acceptable practice in Islam. Thank you.
Thank you very much. I think that's a good way to end this very, very fascinating, very stimulating panel discussion. When I was in Jakarta, invited by Sasakawa Peace Foundation to attend your annual conference in Jakarta, I asked you, and I actually said, please come to Brussels because your message about the diversity and pluralism in Islam and the non-Arab Islam, which is not meant to be anti-Arab, but is very important to us. And we need to hear it here in Brussels, where we have a very monolithic, very monotonous and very routine view of what Islam is today's world. So I would really like to... I'm sorry, I just don't have the time anymore to take more questions. There are refreshments outside, and you can talk to the... The conversation will continue outside. I cannot take any more questions. But I would like to thank you all very much for your very, very pertinent questions. To all my friends and to the panelists, please join me in giving them a warm hand.